Well, beloved listener, my next guest is the Polish journalist Witold Szablowski. He spent much of his career writing about and winning awards for works on authoritarianism and tyranny. His last book, Dancing Bears, subtitled True Stories of People Nostalgic for Life Under Tyranny, explored the stories of people in former communist countries struggling to adapt to their new circumstances. His new book is How to Feed a Dictator, and it finds him returning to the world of tyranny once again. He spent 4 years tracking down the chefs who used to cook for the likes of Pol Pot, Saddam Hussein and Fidel Castro, and he got them to spill the beans on how political tyrants use food and propaganda and their personal lives. Witold joins me now via Skype, I understand, from Warsaw. Witold, welcome. I know you've been in Sydney, and I've been in Warsaw, but here we are talking across the world. Your last book, People Living Under Tyranny, and the new book is essentially People Cooking Under Tyranny. How on earth did you come up with this extraordinary idea?
Hello, Phil. Thank you for having me. And it's a great pleasure to be in Australia in such a great radio as yours. Well, I've been, as you said before, I've been following the tyrannies all over the world. And I many times ask myself the question, how the tyrants are actually born? Where is this turning point where an average person or citizen of a country decides to be a dictator, a tyrant, and then gets the power and then starts doing the horrible things to his nation? And then, because I had an episode in my life when I almost became a chef by myself. That was in my mid-20s, and I work in Copenhagen, and I made a rapid career from a dishwasher to a cook helper and then to a chef. But and I knew that you hear a lot of amazing stories in kitchens, that the chefs, they are amazing storytellers, and whenever they have time, they will tell you really good stories. So just one day I woke up and I realized that I just have to combine these two paths.
Now, dictator's chef isn't the sort of job you advertise for. How did these chefs end up working for the likes of, say, Hussein? I guess there are two ways to become the chef of a dictator, and the first would be to join his revolutionary movement.
Right. That's the first possible way of, let's call it, career with a dictator. So there is just a revolutionary movement. You join the movement, you have some cooking skills. That's the case, for example, of the chef of Fidel Castro, whose name was Erasmo Hernandez. He joined the revolution, the Cuban Revolution, when he was 15. And he began the career as a bodyguard, as a personal bodyguard of Che Guevara. And then when the revolution won and Fidel became the leader of the nation, Erasmo became a bodyguard of Fidel, but he had some cooking skills, so at some occasions he began cooking for Fidel, and then Fidel had him sent to culinary school and had him as a professional cook for over 50 years.
Now, of course, there were so many attempts against Fidel. The CIA alone tried to kill him over 200 times, and clearly the easiest way to kill someone like Castro is to poison him. So it must have been a very tense job.
Oh, yes, it was. And the chef was always under a very big surveillance. Like, his hands was always not double, not triple, not quadruple, but checked by hundreds of people. And it's not only the Secret Service that was checking all the chefs that I talked with, but some of them had special laboratories. For example, Saddam Hussein had a laboratory which hired over 200 people and which only responsibility was checking the food that was served to Saddam and his guests.
200?
Yes, just for that just for that purpose.
Heavens above, heavens above. Look, I want to go back to Saddam, but let's now we're sort of in Cuba, where I understand you were at the time of Barack Obama's visit. Let's stay with Fidel, because I'm fascinated by his relationship with a particular cow. Tell the listener about Fidel and his moo cow.
Well, that was the cow who was in the world's Guinness Records book for giving the biggest daily amounts of milk in the world. And she was an amazing hybrid of two types of cow. And the thing is that Fidel was kind of smart guy, you know, as most of the dictators are. Just a guy who knows about everything. Whatever you would ask Fidel, he would give you an answer. And he was quite engaged into new species of cows and having milk for all the Cuban people, etc. So when they had this cow who was giving these amazing, enormous amounts of milk, he felt in love with that cow. I mean, not literally in love, but he gave a lot of passion to that cow.
We are talking about what they ate rather than their sex lives. So the cow was called Ubre Blanca, White Udder.
Right, and she had her own food tasters. She was that important for Fidel, and she was that important for Cuban Revolution, that she had her own food tasters. They were other cows eating the food before it was served to her. But she had four cows, and she was, because she loved fruits. So she didn't eat anything but fruits. And really,
I understand it was mainly oranges.
And grapefruits. And there were years that Fidel spent more time with Ubre Blanca, or at least there were months when Fidel spent more time with Ubre Blanca than actually ruling the country. So she was an amazing, important cow for Cuba.
And she had classical music played to her all day long to keep her happy.
And to keep her producing the milk. That's correct.
So it was a pretty serious day in Cuba when one day Ubre Blanca suddenly wasn't looking too good.
And the amounts of milk were cut to like half of the record amounts. And then Fidel, like, he was waiting for a couple of months and he was very upset about that. But then he decided that the cow must be killed. Like, the cow was not anymore useful for the revolution, because what can you say, you know, that the capitalists won, that the Ubre Blanca is not producing as much milk as before. So he ordered the killing of Ubre Blanca. They made a monument of the cow. She had a full page in Granma, which is kind of propaganda newspaper in Cuba.
Tell me about Fidel's other chef, who I believe these days has a very successful restaurant in Havana.
It's Erasmo. It's the same guy who joined the revolution when he was 15. And when he went from Che to Fidel, and then he was sent to the culinary school, and then he spent like 50 years cooking for Fidel. But at the same time, you know, in the 90s, Cuba was going through a horrible crisis. Like, Fidel was very good at taking money from Soviet Union. Like, he masterminded this. But when Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba bankrupted immediately, like a few months later. And there was this horrible period for all Cubans called periodo especial, which means the special period, when average Cuban lost about 7 kilograms on weight. And that's the moment when the Cubans, and especially Fidel, understood that he should allow people to open some private business. Otherwise, they might, you know, die of starvation. And actually, Erasmo, the personal chef of Fidel, became the first capitalist of Cuba, because he was among the four chefs who got the first four licenses to open a private restaurant in a communist Cuba.
Vitold, you're a great storyteller. I would like you to now tell me the story about Idi Amin's chef and his brush with death after feeding Amin's gluttonous 13-year-old son a particular curry.
I call it a story about a fart that saved a dozen of lives, if I can say this, if I can put it this way. Because the young son of Idi Amin, a teenage boy called Moses, got a horrible problem with his stomach. And that was the moment, like, Idi Amin, a bloody ruler of Uganda, had few... That was the moment when he had been in power for a couple of years, and he was getting really crazy. Like, he started killing people from his advisors, he killed his wives, and his all his personnel, all the people working for him, they knew that he might start killing them. And that was the moment, because Amin was very furious. He thought that his son had been poisoned. So he came to the kitchen with a gun in his hand, and he said that if anything happens to the boy, and if he dies, all the personnel will be killed that evening. And the personal chef and the director of the kitchens in the presidential palace was a man called Otonde Odera, who's one of the main characters in my book. And Otonde took the son and ran away with him from the palace to the hospital that worked with the family of president. And then he had him checked. And the doctor, you know, he pushed the belly of the young boy, of Moses. And then came the fart that saved all those people, because after pushing his belly, Moses felt much better. And he just overate, like, because Amin had really good chefs in the kitchen, and they had something with that dish which is called pilaf with raisin. Very sweet, a lot of calories. And Moses ate a lot of that. And obviously the reason of his problems was that pilaf, not anyone trying to poison him. But if the chef didn't had a cold blood, they could all be killed that evening.
You've told so many stories. Tell me now about Saddam Hussein's bottle of Tabasco sauce.
Oh yeah, that's one of my favorite stories from the whole book. Because it has what I really like. I mean, it's short story, but it tells you so much about Saddam. So one day Saddam invited his friends, his wife, and some people of his staff, like his advisors, etc., to the boat on the Tigris River. And it was a beautiful sunny day, and Saddam decided that that's the day where he's gonna cook for his beloved people. And the chef, his name is Abu Ali, he's another amazing figure. He prepared everything for the president to cook. Like, he prepared meat, he prepared salad, he prepared the barbecue, and the president was supposed to make the meat by himself. And then the food was served. And all the people who were on the boat, they immediately had a horrible pain in their throats. They felt like their throats were burning, all the people. And because Saddam was crazy, like, he was really killing people for nothing. So they all thought Saddam
has poisoned us, yeah.
And they had no idea why. So when the chef was recalling this story and telling it to me, he had tears in his eyes just when he reminded the moment, because he really thought he was dying. Like, he told me he was thinking about his family, about his wife, about his children, about the good life he had before, but he was sure he's dying. And then after a few minutes, he didn't die, but his throat was still burning, but a bit less. And then they understood that it was the way, you know, this is a moment when a dictator makes a joke. And the joke was that Saddam put a lot of Tabasco sauce to all the food that was served to his friends and to his personnel. And they didn't know the Tabasco sauce. And Saddam thought it's so funny that his close allies, they were all thinking that they were dying. And he was sitting and laughing And he thought it would be very funny.
He's a laugh a minute, that Saddam. It's a pity that your journeys didn't take you to Washington, D.C., because I'd love to have seen a story on Donald Trump. We know that his diet lacks subtlety. I believe he has a passion for Big Macs. But when you're doing a second edition, you really must include the Donald, Vitold. Now, I should point out your book took almost 4 years to complete. You crossed four continents, from a godforsaken village in the Kenyan savannah to the Cambodian jungle where the last of the Khmer Rouge were in hiding, and it was often very, very difficult to win the trust of the chefs you wanted to talk to.
Oh, yeah. It's the hardest to find and the hardest to talk was the chef of Saddam Hussein, because he had been hiding since the American invasion to Iraq, which means that when I started looking for him, he had been already hiding for 14 or 15 years. And he didn't want me to find him. He didn't make things easy. And it took me over 3 years to find him and to make him talk with me. And it was like from James Bond movies. We were meeting in the outskirts of the town of Baghdad in a little hotel. We were having two different rooms and then going from one to another. And it was really strange at the beginning, but then we built kind of trustment. And after a week, we were freely walking in the center of Baghdad, and he was calling me his friend and his brother. But regarding Donald Trump, I think I'm afraid his kitchen will be so boring. This guy really seems like someone who's eating mainly McDonald's. In McDonald's, just with golden forks and knives. That's all I think.
Vitold, I know that you're working on a culinary history of the old Soviet Union, and that you've interviewed chefs who cooked in Chernobyl, chefs who cooked for Brezhnev and Gorbachev and Yeltsin. I look forward to that. And thank you very, very much for your time. Vitold Shablowski, Polish journalist. He's won so many awards, he must be embarrassed by them. He's based in Warsaw. That's where he is at this very moment. And the new book, How to Feed a Dictator, is out next month from Penguin Random House. And I've just been riffling through the reviews, and they're almost indigestible in their ecstatic responses to Vitold's book.